Good evening.
Good evening.
How nice it is to see everybody, to be together. Is anybody here for the first time? Oh, welcome. Welcome to the Zen Center. It's nice to have you here. My name is Patrice. I've been a student here for a while. I like to start out my talk tonight by just expressing my love and gratitude and respect and my deep appreciation for my teacher who sat in this seat for many years, Karin Soban, Catherine Thanis. We all miss her so much. So the people in the back, if you can hear me, would you just raise your hand and give me a little signal if you can hear me? I'm okay? All right. So, fall I've been rereading and studying Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's called Informal Talks on Zen Meditation and Practice by Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center. And it's now in its 30th printing. I saw a little story in David Chadwick's book, Crooked Cucumber. He told a story of the day when the first box of the first books, the first printing, arrived at San Francisco Zen Center. And he said everybody was bustling around. And of course, it was hardcover. And Suzuki Roshi took it out, and he sort of looked at it and checked it out. And he said, "It's a good book." And he said, "I didn't write it, but it looks like a pretty good book." And then apparently later he said, "I read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind to see what the understanding of my disciples is." So my I had a little sort of a fall practice period for myself. I'll tell you more about this past September through December, and I sort of was focusing on one particular talk in this book called Beyond Consciousness. So just about everything I'm going to quote from his book tonight is between pages 127 and 130. And I'll just start by reading a little bit of it. Beyond consciousness, our true nature is beyond our conscious experience. It is only in our conscious experience that we find practice and enlightenment, or good and bad. But whether or not we have experience of our true nature, what exists there beyond consciousness actually exists. And it is there that we have to establish the foundation of our practice. And Suzuki Roshi goes on to quote Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen School. Dogen Zenji says, "You should establish your practice in delusion." Suzuki says, "Even though you think you are in delusion, your pure mind is there. To realize pure mind in your delusion is practice." So this is, I've sort of been chewing on this for months and focusing on a specific area of my life that has really been causing me some suffering for myself and for others, sort of an ongoing situation involving inner and outer conflict in the workplace. Probably none of you guys have that, so you can just return to Zazen if it's not relevant. So you may or may not have encountered a person in your workplace or even your life anywhere that has some power, some influence, some authority that, they make decisions that affect you, maybe affect the way you do your job or the way you have to accomplish your responsibilities. And you might disagree with those decisions and that the person implements. And if you're like me, you would start to think things like, "Well, that's pretty wrong and pretty stupid what you're asking me to do." And then you might even get angry, which I have been, and I've exerted many efforts to change myself, to change the situation, struggle, struggle, struggle. So as a last resort, I thought, I'll practice with it. The only reason I went to the practice was because, of course, all my traditional methods of dealing with conflict had not amounted to much. They had failed miserably. So my traditional methods are five in number, and they shall be called. Number one, invoke patience and endure the situation. Maybe it'll change, just sort of tolerate it. Number two, this is a common solution for women, avoid the conflict and suppress the anger. Of course, these didn't work. Number three, when those failed, I turned to a last-ditch effort of communication and problem-solving, arguing as needed. That didn't work too well either. So when all that failed, I moved on to blaming and complaining, disparaging others, and when that became absolutely intolerable, this is going on for probably a period of 2 years, I tried to persuade myself, tried to force myself to sort of accept the situation and let go. It's not going to change. So I prefer to cling to these traditional methods, even if they're futile, because they are familiar. And I'm sort of a stubborn person. I don't mind, you know, even though they sort of form a weather pattern and you sort of get into a swamp and kind of like a quicksand, you know, I don't mind because I keep having in the back of my mind, eventually I'll win. I'll accomplish something, you know. But, you know, and I really do believe, I believe that my way is the best way, and that just keeps me going, you know. I don't mind mixing it up, anger and conflict. I came from a family where I had to do that quite a bit to sort of survive. I used to tell Catherine, she's like, you know, I'm not one of those sunny, cheerful persons on the sunny side of life, you know. I'm not like the otters and dolphins that swim and play on the surface of the ocean. Catherine would say, no, you're pretty much a bottom feeder. Well, I love that. But my way is the best way. The other person is wrong and I'm right. So Suzuki Rishi says, actually good and bad is not the point. Whether or not you make yourself peaceful is the point. And whether or not you stick to it. So I sort of started my more, you know, practice-oriented approach to this by thinking, okay, what, you know, what's really the, this is, obviously there's delusional thinking going on here, what's going on? Thomas Cleary describes delusion as conditioned habits of perception. So instead of a direct experience of reality, instead of reality experiencing itself directly, along with us all together, delusion is more like I'm sort of interpreting it through my karmic filter, through my habits of perception. And those habits fail to accord in some fundamental way with, as Suzuki Roshi would say, things as it is. So I really, one of the things that Zen teaches is that there's no really such a thing as a separate self-existence, a separate, independent, individual, autonomous, and completely separate from others. But ordinarily, most of us experience ourselves this way. It's as a self with boundaries that we need to protect, and if somebody or something threatens those boundaries, we want to protect our boundaries. So it's a very ordinary, commonplace thinking and experience, the perception of a separate self. And even right now, in this moment, we're experiencing this moment in the Zendo from what we probably feel to be unique individual perspectives and positions in the mandalas of our lives, the mandala of the Zendo. We each have a separate life going on. We each came here for our own reasons. I sort of, you know, had a very busy day at work, and after work sort of made the transition to come here. I thought, tonight's the night I have to give my talk at the Zendo. I have to go down there, you know. And it's just, you know, I'm thinking I from the ego perspective. But really, if we think of the deeper perspective, the experience of ourself, Zen teaches, it codependently arises. Our existence arises. We inter are, Thich Nhat Hanh says, in his order of interbeing. All the generations of my personal history, all the generations of your personal history, all the multitudes and generations of our ancestors, the history of this whole regional history of the United States, the history of invasion and conquest and immigration, our collective history as a species, all of this is contributing to our experience right now. We could even look down to the level of the quantum field into which, you know, most of our substance is really air sort of strung together on protons and electrons and neutrinos. And we could go all the way back to the big Bang, where everybody existed as one, all matter existed as one point of infinite density. But anyway, I'm not a physicist, so I prefer to stick more with the ego-based interpretation. I feel separate. And when I get in a conflict like this, I am separate. And I'll do whatever it takes to defend my position. Of course, it doesn't feel very good, and I end up judging the other person, then I end up judging myself. Because even if I have a lot of evidence for my position and I want to argue it, once I start disparaging the other person or making them inferior to me, it doesn't feel very good to me. You know, I say, you know, okay, I get it. You're an idiot. You know, it doesn't feel very good. You know, it's kind of embarrassing. You start to feel shit like, you know, okay, you know, it's not right to judge someone else. I sort of start to regret it. I'm not a good person. I don't want to be that judgmental, critical person. I've worked so hard in my life to come to terms with my judgments of self and others. So, you know, right away I'm starting to sort of cope with my delusion or get rid of it. I'm trying to create a new internal experience for myself or get to a different place. So Suzuki Roshi says, if you try to expel the delusion, it will only persist the more. And your mind will become busier and busier trying to cope with it. When you start to cope with it, you'll be involved in delusion. And Dogen again says, even though you think you're in delusion, your pure mind is there. Suzuki Roshi says, so you should establish your practice in your delusion. To have delusion is practice. This is to attain enlightenment before you realize it. Even though you do not realize it, you haven't. So I was fortunate enough to be able to spend some time at Tassajara Zen Center last summer, a few weeks, which is the Zen mountain center that Suzuki Roshi established in the wilderness between Big Sur and Carmel Valley. For some of you who might not have been there, it's a beautiful place. It's a Zen monastery. In the summertime, they open up to guest student practice. And I was fortunate enough to hear a talk by Reb Anderson, senior Dharma teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center. And it sort of was a turning moment for me in this quicksand struggle I've been involved in, trying to, you know, like, deal and cope with my anger and conflict. So he gave a talk on great compassion. Probably it's online if some of you want to hear it. It was probably about mid to late August at Tassajara. Sorry, Reb Anderson. Yeah. And his talk was on the activity of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, the regarder of the cries of the world. And Reb, he said, he sort of broke it down for us. He says, there are four steps in the activity of Kuan Yin. So, great, four steps. We're going to learn the four steps. I'm all ears, Reb. I think the first step regards all inner and outer cries. Regards all inner and outer cries. And here Reb gave an example that was greatly encouraging to me. Reb said, it's like when we say to someone, you're an idiot. He said, it's like when we say, you don't know what you're talking about, and you should get out of here. You should just get out of this Zen center. And I could see that, you know, Reb had experienced somewhat of what I was talking. I thought, even Reb thinks like this. Maybe even Buddha thought like this, you know. I know for a fact Jesus did, but that's another of my sides. So, you know, of course I've been saying this to myself for months and judging myself from it and knowing it's not a good practice and feeling guilty about it. But Reb was like, this is an inner cry and you need to hear it and you need to listen to it. You need to be with it. And the activity of compassion is not to judge it and not to reject it and not to even think about it. Just be with it. Be with that suffering and that pain that's crying out in such rage and pain and anger. It's there. So regard it. Regard it. The Dalai Lama, he talks about his policy of compassion. Oh no, policy of kindness. And I saw a great little, he had a little paragraph on one of his calendars that was talking about anger. He said, you know, anger, it's like that relative that you're going to have to relate to. Or that person that you're always going to have to see no matter what. So he says, so when you see them coming, you should just say, okay, here they come. And you should take some precaution. You should take some precaution. And that, you know, over time, the person, the anger, it has you know, you tell yourself, no good will come of it. No good will come of it. And over time, you know, you sort of develop a different feeling in the presence of anger. The anger is still there, but there's a little more space around it. So I kind of shifted from, instead of, you know, sort of criticizing myself, like, it's not kind to think of someone as an idiot. And worse yet, my colleagues and I were saying this to each other, you know, like, he's an idiot. But, you know, so, you know, still really a lot of wrong speech and so forth. But, so I sort of started to try and make this shift to regard my internal, first of all, I wasn't even identifying this as an internal cry, but then to regard it as an internal cry rather than trying to expel it. If you try to expel the delusion, it will only persist the more. Your mind will become busier and busier trying to cope with it. Suzuki Roshi says, that is not so good, he says. So first step, regards all inner and outer cries. And the second step, Reb says, he was doing this, step two, develops a concentrated mind that is open and flexible. Develops a concentrated mind that is open and flexible. So the Bodhisattva Guanyin regards all inner and outer cries, then develops a concentrated mind that is open and flexible. Well, how does this happen? Well, first of all, I'll say it's a matter of faith, because what we want to develop or practice is already present. Our original nature, our Buddha nature, original mind, before we realize it, Buddha nature is. Whether or not we have experience of our true nature, what exists there beyond consciousness actually exists. And it is there that we have to establish the foundation of our practice. So you could know this. Of course, practice is more than knowing it. We have to embody this and practice it. And Suzuki Roshi says, when you practice Zazen, your problems will practice Zazen too. I thought, that's great. So it's sort of, you know, Zazen is a devotional practice for me. It's not so much that I love to sit. I kind of do love to sit, but not every time. But it's a practice of love. And the point is just to sit. I saw this on a Suzuki Roshi said, the point is to just sit. Just sit for the sake of Zazen. That is to have a real way-seeking mind. For the sake of Zazen. It's like if you do something for the sake of someone you love. You're doing it just for their sake. So to sit for the sake of Zazen. Luckily, I was practicing at Tassajara. I could sit twice a day. There's a lot of structure for that. So, of course, that's the way in our practice that we develop a concentrated mind that is open and flexible. We have a faith in our Buddha nature, in Buddha nature. It's not our Buddha nature, but we have a faith in Buddha nature, and we practice to realize our open and flexible mind. Step three is then able to trust breathing in and out, able to be truly present. So develops a concentrated mind that is open and flexible, is then able to trust breathing in and out, able to be truly present. Suzuki says, I want you to have a firm, wide, imperturbable conviction in your Zazen of just sitting. Just to sit, that's enough. When you sit in Zazen, you will have the most pure, genuine experience of the empty state of mind. Actually, emptiness is not even a state of mind, but the original essence of mind, which Buddha and the sixth patriarch, I think that's that Wei Ning, sixth patriarch, which Buddha and the sixth patriarch experienced. Essence of mind, original face, Buddha nature, emptiness. All these would mean the absolute calmness of our mind. The absolute calmness of our mind. Kind of like the ocean. You know, if you're by the ocean, well, there's so many waves and tides and splashings. But if you look at the ocean from above the earth, it's so calm. The absolute calmness of our mind. Okay, working up to the fourth step. Regards all inner and outer cries. Develops a concentrated mind that is open and flexible, is then able to trust breathing in and out, able to be truly present. So, you know, I practice Zazen a lot with my conflict. So step four, it's all leading up to this. We're all sitting there. Reb, what's he going to say? Reb says, step four, leaps into wisdom. He said, that sounds great. So, you know, then we're waiting to see how Reb's going to explain it. So he's just looking at everybody. Then he goes, leaps into wisdom. And that's all he says. That's all he's talking about. What do you mean, leaps into wisdom? What, you know, what is that? That's the entire formula, leaps into wisdom. That's all they said about him. What Suzuki said, because we are not good right now, and because we want to be better, but when we attain the transcendental mind, we go beyond things as they are and as they should be. In the emptiness of our original mind, they are one, and there we find our perfect composure. So this leaps into wisdom. I mean, he didn't say anything more about it, really. He went back to talking about some other things, but it recalled for me a trip in to China that I took with a pilgrimage with a group of about 25 women in 2005 from Green Gulch and San Francisco Zen Center, and our own Sue Walter, who used to practice here. We went to the mountain island of Putoshan. Putoshan is a mountainous site of pilgrimage and devotion to the Bodhisattva Guanyin in the China Sea. And there are a lot of temples there. The whole island is temples and statues. And we took a ferry from mainland China to get there. And there's a small temple that guards one area of the coast where there's a stone, sort of a big stone. It's probably, I want to say, it's about 6 feet tall, big massive stone in the China Sea. And on that stone, there's a footprint. And that stone is called Guanyin's Leap. And Bodhisattva Guanyin is said to have leapt from an island that's about, I guess, 10 kilometers offshore called Loja. She was, before she was the Bodhisattva Guanyin, the legend is she was meditating and studying and practicing on this island, Loja. And in the leap to Putoshan, that was the realization of Guanyin. So even Guanyin had to practice, according to that legend. So these four steps, they really inspired me to continue to practice, to continue to stay with practice, rather than to be sort of swept aside by all these attachments to conflict and storms and reactions that I just was having for so long. Reb said, we don't like our delusions, we love them. I love that. And he also said of the Bodhisattva Guanyin, her belief in the self-existence of beings is no hindrance. So yeah, we do. We really are individual people. We are pretty much leading different lives out there, yes and no. But the belief in self-existence is really no hindrance, even in conflict. Activity of great compassion. So I'll tell you a little bit about another experience I had at Tassajara that really helped me this summer with this whole conflict thing, especially with the frustration and anger part. Because I was under the influence of the other person. They had some authority to tell me what to do, legitimate authority. And I was unable to influence them. I felt like a victim, and this was unacceptable to me. I really didn't, you know, I was fighting with myself and struggling, and I was really trying to reject and extinguish this feeling of powerlessness, of victimization, of oppression. And Catherine used to talk to us right here in this room from this cushion about the Zen story of the empty boat. Probably some of you remember the Zen story and have even heard it from Catherine. And she would say that our encounters with each other are like boats floating in sort of a foggy mist. We can't, you know, really see what's going on too well, but you can tell when another boat bumps into you. Sort of a jarring experience. And she said, you know, when another boat bumps into you, you get pretty aggravated. And you get pretty aggravated at the person who's in that boat. You can say, you know, because someone's not really steering their boat correctly and they should get out of your way, right? And you might yell at them or disparage them, whatever. You could have all sorts of criticisms. But in fact, when you get close enough to see, you can see that the boat is actually empty, that there's no one steering it and there's really no one to be angry at. So this is sort of a teaching about the emptiness of self, a teaching about much more, I'm sure, but that's how I took it. So my summer practice at Tassajara, I was there for about 3.5 weeks this summer, and they assigned me as the women's bathhouse attendant, which I know Kathy has done. Maybe some others of you have practiced that at Tassajara. At Tassajara, they have a, those of you who haven't been, there's a beautiful hot springs, there's a bathhouse with a men's side, a women's side. And the job of bathhouse attendant is doing and doing again. You clean, then you clean again. You clean, then the guests use the bathhouse, and you clean again. You have to clean the entire bathhouse, including two beautiful plunges that they have, a hot plunge and a warm plunge outside. And the hot plunge is about half the size of this room, I would say, and very deep. I'm going to say hundreds, if not thousands, of gallons of water. I really don't know how to estimate that, but it is a lot of water. To clean it, from the practice point of view, it's just doing the next thing, and you just do it, and you just do your practice, and it's beautiful. From the ego point of view, the plunge is complicated. It's tricky, and it's a little nerve-wracking, because it has to be perfect. The indoor plunge is sort of the centerpiece of the bathhouse, and the women, you know, they really want it to be perfect, and so does Tassajara. So every few days, you have to drain all the water out. You have to scrub it all, spray the whole thing down, hose it down. Then there's three separate valves, the hot spring valve and the cool spring. You have to adjust all these hundreds of gallons perfectly to exactly 108 degrees, not 110 degrees, not 106 degrees, 108 degrees. And it's about a four-hour process to go through this hole. You start it, you leave the Zendo at service at 7 o'clock. You're starting it, you know, you're running back and forth from breakfast and all through the morning. It's about a four-hour process to get it perfect. And so you're doing this every few days. So I'm going to read something that is from my summer journal entry of what happened one day when I was cleaning the indoor plunge, and a fellow Zen student came to help me. Now, I had actually requested that somebody from the shop come and help me because I had seen what looked like an empty or abandoned sort of wasp nest on the wall, sort of a dirt sort of thing. But it didn't look to me like any insects were flying. But, you know, I didn't want anybody to take up residence there because, as another student said, you know, naked people and stinging insects don't, you know, really belong in the same space. So I had asked somebody from the shop to come help me. So a student came to help me, which I had requested. And so this is sort of an empty boat experience to me. So I made it sort of into a poem, which I'll read. And the last four lines of the poem, or maybe it's five lines. Five lines. The last five lines are the gatha, or the inscription, the verse that's above the altar at the bathhouse of Tassajara. So you'll hear that at the end. So this is called Bathhouse Attendant. Bathhouse attendant, draining, scrubbing, spraying, hose it down and refill with love. Hear the way unfolds with a mix of hot and cool spring water. Adjust the valves, coil the pale green hose on the wet slate floor. Admire the light dancing on clear water blended to perfect temperature. The indoor plunge reaches its level slowly, while morning sun sparkles on blue tiles and Canyon Wren sings along with the music of Tassajara Creek. Suddenly, here is shop girl. Tools of her trade in hand, she moves with purpose, trains a practiced eye on the dirt-brown wasp nest high on the wall. Then one deft scrape of her long-handled metal blade drops a crumbling mud dirt bomb into the still water of the plunge below. One deft scrape of her long-handled metal blade drops a crumbling mud dirt bomb into the still water of the plunge below. Somehow, it falls in slow motion. Shop girl laughs, pleased with her work. It's empty, she points to the fallen nest, smiling. But I can only see dark clouds of mud and dirt spreading like ink in perfect water as shop girl Mission accomplished, sails away. From the depths of karma, like a predatory fish, rises an urgent need to complain to someone. And I do not like Shop Girl anymore. It's all true. Late morning, though, in front of the bathhouse, the wind exhales long and warm, and hundreds of brown and yellow leaves cover again the newly raked gravel. By mid-afternoon, the blue scrub jay has perched on her favorite sycamore branch, directly above the scrubbed wooden bathhouse deck, where every day she relieves herself in the same spot. In the nearby bathroom, a grateful guest uses the just-polished toilet. After dark that evening, the full moon blots out my plan for stargazing as she outshines the Milky Way. Next day at the bathhouse, with all beings, I wash body and mind, free from dust, pure and shining within and without. Next day at the bathhouse, with all beings, I wash body and mind, free from dust, pure and shining within and without. Whether or not we have experience of our true nature, Suzuki Roshi, whether or not we have experience of our true nature, what exists there beyond consciousness actually exists. And it is there that we have to establish the foundation of our practice. So thank you very much. So maybe I guess if we wanted to have some conversation or questions. Kathy. You know exactly.
Well, yeah. And it's just very moving to me to hear how you describe that. And what I was thinking when you were talking about your practice with your difficult situation at work is, you know, not that it isn't okay when other people change. I mean, not that that can't be a good thing to happen. But if we expect it to happen and if we think that's the only way we're ever going to be happy, we're doomed. Mm-hmm. To endless suffering.
That's
so
right.
Here
that's
you work with that on this one, you know, on your own mind and body, you know, is really just such a deep expression of saving all beings. Because whether or not the other person changes, you know, breathe and live and have the right to have some ease, you mm-hmm. know. And so it's just a very powerful teaching, I think. And your very careful explanation of your own process. And it may never change, you know. You will always, yeah. It will always arise.
Yeah, it really almost doesn't matter anymore at this point.
Surprise.
Yeah, Catherine, you know, yeah. Years and years and years ago, probably the first time I heard her say this was when I was first practicing at this, I mean, like, you know, years ago, almost a couple decades ago, she would sit here and she would say, abandon hope. You know, and I would say, are you kidding? At that point, I was sort of new to practice, and I have Catholic roots too. I have sort of a dual Catholic Buddhist practice. And hope, man, that's like a faith, hope, and love, man, that's it. She was abandoned hope. And I was like, what are you talking about? I just didn't get it. But now I really get it because it's like this expectation. You know, it's like a needing something from somebody else. For me, it was really needing to have an influence, needing to really have some acknowledgement that what I was talking about, my perception was really valid and was being disregarded. That really pissed me off, I'll have to say. But abandoning hope is the key. It really is.
Well, because really, it's not really different from a shop girl being proud of herself, doing her job.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
totally messing up your 4 hours of careful labor. Yeah. And yet, happy, she was doing her job.
Yeah.
And then the question for you is, what's your practice with that?
Yeah, I mean, it was just so striking. You know, well, okay, am I going to blame the wind? Am I going to blame the bird? You know? Am I going to blame the empty boat? Thank you, Kathy. Charlie-san.
So you talk about beyond consciousness, and I think you're trained as a psychologist.
Yeah, I am a psychologist.
And I'm just wondering, as a psychologist, how does that relate to subconscious? Is it the same? Or,
Well, the way I've been practicing with that, Charlie, or hearing it, is sort of like beyond awareness. Sort of like, you know, we might not be aware of Buddha nature, but it's real. It's right here. It's of course everywhere, but it's also in this body. Now, that was a big one for me, because I was born and raised Catholic and had a lot of sort of unlearning about certain aspects of Catholicism to do before I could come back to sort of a understanding of the true mysticism of Catholicism, which is beautiful. But one of the early teachings that I sort of had to undo, which is that the divine is out here somewhere. Well, up there, really. Okay, you know. And so to really feel in my body, Buddha nature is everywhere. And I don't have to look somewhere for rescue or for escape or for relief. But right here, right, even though I don't feel it, even though I'm not aware of it, it's really here. It actually exists. I really sort of got stuck on these pages, 127 to 130. I was rereading the whole book, which goes up only to about page 137, and I just couldn't go past page 130. I still have it. This was a very deep thing for me to say, in my body, you know, right here, right now. But, you know, we had to practice. Yeah. Thank you, Charlie. Richard.
First, could you succinctly, in a few words, say how at work you have now come to some detente or some solution with this situation?
Well, it's really sort of in the key that Kathy and I were talking about, which was through first of all, compassion through my own experience, which I was having a hard time getting there because I was so busy fighting. This is going to be more than a few words, Richard, I'm sorry. But so the first, regarding the cries, and then, you know, just the Zazen, the Tassajara practice really put me in a space where I could really be compassionate to myself, sort of get a bigger perspective on the empty boat sort of thing, and then that helped me to just abandon my hope. Like, it's okay. I have to say, leaps into wisdom. I mean, that's all. It's not something that I did or that I can explain.
No, I understand.
Yeah.
I want to ask that, and there's a follow-up that, because I have a friend that isn't a nurse who deals with young, unwed mothers and so forth, and now doesn't have the problem. For years had a supervisor who she just couldn't work with, and I wish, I don't know, I probably have to get a copy of your talk for her. I wish she was here, but
well, there is a microphone around my neck, so it might be a copy somewhere.
But the question when we would talk about it was, of course, you know, you need to take yourself out of being a suffering victim of this. Somehow you need to be liberated and, you know, let her live her life. But there was another question, and this is where it gets interesting. Is that superior causing harm by what she's doing? You know, you disagree. Well, if you just disagree and it's just an ego thing, that's one thing. But what if in the down the line she's actually creating harm for others?
I know.
And you as an under, whatever the term would be, you know, she as someone who's serving her, it's in a sense there's a point where it stops being a disagreement and starts being something else, something where maybe you have a responsibility to do something about it, because it's not just a disagreement, it's where you're noticing she's actually causing harm.
Yeah.
It's just this interesting little additional question about, I don't sit by and say, well, I'm just going to find a Zen way of dealing with this. You've got to do that, because you may have a responsibility to, in some way, stop that person from hurting others.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think that... you know, in a situation that calls for some sort of grievance or ethical intervention, those avenues are provided. Now, my situation, that was an aspect of my situation, but it doesn't rise to the level of grievance, because in my situation, I think it's going to be a long, long, long time before people realize what might be the harm in the situation. But certainly, yeah, I mean, Buddhism doesn't tell us not to fight against, you know, oppression or injustice or anything like that. It's more like how you do it. And one could certainly do that from a place of peacefulness, with engaged passion, even anger, without, you know, suffering or adding additional suffering to oneself and others, I think.
I get angry at the entry book. And also I spent a whole summer, a whole practice period doing the bathhouse. And I really appreciated your poem.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Liz.
Trace, thank you for your talk.
And, thank you, Liz.
I just had a kind of day of anger and really appreciate your everything. And it's kind of feeling how I think of that step of hearing the cry of within, having compassion for it. Really contemplate that. And I feel like then there's this step of how to be compassionate with all the regret and the knowing that the wrong speech isn't helpful. Just that whole package.
Yeah, it's painful. That's forgiving ourselves, I think. It's forgiving ourselves, you know, and sort of it's another layer of acceptance and vow and repentance. You know, we fall down, we get up, we do it again. Vow is, I think, from what I understand of living in vow, it's that compass, you know. Chino-san.
The leap into wisdom is intriguing. And reason tells me that we will be leaping from ignorance, I suppose, into wisdom, you know? But like, if I believe or have faith in, more appropriately said, I have faith in this practice realization, what's the leap?
I think it's a koan. I think it's not an it. I think leaps into wisdom, it's hard to add or take away from that phrase. And I think probably, like Charlie was pointing to, it may be beyond consciousness even. That's about the best I can come up with right now. Leap into faith, perhaps. Dana-san. Thanks, Dana.
I don't need to defend the shop girl, but...
Dana, thank you. Dana is a shop girl, so she knows. Dana herself is a Tassajara shop girl.
I don't think there's any way I could do that right now, so...
It probably was made worse by the day before when she fixed the faucet and left all the things in the, yeah, and the dirt and that, and when I had just cleaned the tub, but anyway.
There's always like the past and the present, right? I was just going to sort of add something to what Jean asked you about leaps. I often feel like when you hear someone like Rev say leaps into wisdom, sitting on the edge of your seat, like, and how does that happen?
Exactly.
And because, you know, we think of intentionality, and a lot of the practice realization teaching is, it's not like you plan it.
That's right.
Right? Yes. That it happens, it's always available to you, and it happens. Yes. Like if you're quiet enough to let the regarder of the cries of the world see you, rather than help others, or to do both simultaneously. I don't know if that's kind of the intention of, or I use the word intention, but the meaning of that.
Yeah. Well said. You know, I mean, thank you for that. I also thought of Dogen's phrase of, you know, to go forth and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves as enlightenment. I think we're probably, are we getting to time here? So
8:30. I knew
7:31, so.
Yeah. 8:30, ha ha ha, that's a joke.
Yeah, for a second I freaked out. I thought I was going to have another hour to cover.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, Patrice, keep on.
Yeah.
We can do wisdom here.
So, well, I'll just say, again, thank you very much. What a pleasure it's been to spend this time with you and to you know, it's another part of sort of practice to have spent this time with you. Thank you so much. Beings are numberless.